TPN, welcome back to the Pilot Network Podcast. I'm Matt, co-host of the show, and we are very lucky today to bring you Buck Windham, author of Hogs in the Sand, A-10 pilot, also flying L-39s and some warbirds and an airline pilot as well. So the man has a lot of experience in this crazy aviation world. Buck, welcome to the show.
Hey, Matt, it's great to be with you and great to be on the Pilot Network.
Awesome. Yeah. So we have a close mutual friend, Mike Schulter. So I was really fortunate that he introduced us and introduced me to your book. And it was a lot of fun to dig into it and really start to read. I have to admit, I'm not all the way through it yet. I'm more of an audiobook kind of a guy, but I went and got the hard cover right away because I'm going for an autograph later at some point when we get to meet up in person. So congratulations on the book. And I think rather than me talking about it, what I really want to do is give you an opportunity to kind of tell us a little bit about who you are and how you got to the point where you are in your career. And obviously this book was foundational, you know, talks about a foundational time in your career, but maybe you can kind of give us a 30,000 foot view of what you do now and how you got there.
Well, thanks very much. Very fortunate to have grown up in a family who supported me, first of all. And I loved flying ever since I was 4 years old. When I was 11, I saw my first A-10. I was sitting on the beach in South Carolina with my little sister making sandcastles. And up the beach comes a couple of A-10s. And I didn't know what they were. I knew they looked really cool. And I had to do a lot of research back in the pre-internet days to find out what they were. And I basically set my goal towards being an A-10 pilot. I didn't even know what that meant. I didn't even know what it would entail. But I started flying general aviation when I was, 14, 15, started flying gliders, got my glider rating when I was 16, and then went to school at Embry-Riddle down in Daytona Beach, Florida, and went in the ROTC program there, again, with the intent of being an Air Force pilot and flying an A-10. Went to pilot training. Did well enough that I kind of got my first choice, which was the A-10. So I went to, and I continued to fly general aviation all that time also and still do. Flew the A-10 out of RAF Alconbury in England. We were deployed in December of 1990 when the Gulf War was, or when the Operation Desert Shield was well underway. We were sent down there and we were there for 6 months. So I flew the entire Desert Storm from day one to day last. Yeah, so got airborne on the first day as one of the first probably 10 guys to fly the A-10 in combat. While I was down there in the desert, I kept a very careful journal of everything that happened, everything I did, everything I thought about, everything that was going through my cranium. And I sat on it for a number of years, and I didn't really, I knew it was going to be a book someday, but someday it turned into 25 years, and then I finally realized, hey, I really got to get this thing out there or time's going to pass me by. So, and the last few years, I really, really knuckled down and turned it into a book that you would want to read. You really don't want to read a guy's journal, day-to-day events. But I turned it into a book that I thought would put people in the cockpit and let them know what it was like to fly an A-10. Even though it was a long time ago, it's still the A-10, still does a great job, and the guys that are flying it today have an even more capable airplane than they did back then. So let's see, along the way, I got into flying warbirds, started doing that when I was in England, and then when I moved back to the States, I continued that and got a job teaching in jet warbirds, sort of went along with what I was doing at the time, which was flying T-38s is what I did after the A-10. And I've been doing that ever since, so 20-something years, and almost 28 years now I've been flying jet warbirds. So that's very rewarding. Still fly general aviation, small airplanes from Cubs to Stearmans and everything in between. And so I just have a great time with it. It's my life. Airplanes.
And you're building an airplane, right?
I'm building an RB-8. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's quite the project there.
Yeah, it is. It really is. Yeah.
Did you do the fast build kit, or are you doing it all from scratch?
started out as a fast build kit, and has turned into a slow build kit because of all the modifications that I'm making and all the crazy stuff I'm doing to it. So it's been going way too long, and I'm hoping to finish it up in the next couple of years.
So. That's awesome. Well, that's a fun project. In writing the book, obviously you kept your journal, as you mentioned, and at some point you thought maybe this could be a book, maybe this could be something that I could preserve for posterity, because that was obviously a very dynamic time, as Desert Shield and Desert Storm was kicking off. And as you were sitting down to actually turn this journal into a book, what did you find that you didn't know about writing a novel or a full page, a full book at that point?
Any kind of a narrative of one's life, or even just a novel, has got to have an arc. Got to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's got to be tied together, and it's got to be something that will keep the reader moving through it. You can't have too many details. Nobody wants to hear what you had for breakfast every day. You also have to keep it moving so they keep turning the page. So that was kind of the interesting part of it. And really, the way you figure out how to do that is just read a lot. Just read a lot of good books, and there are a lot of good books out there. So I tried to use as much of my journal as I could, tried to actually use the actual wording that I used at the time. I spent about an hour, hour and a half every night writing. And so with the goal toward writing a book. So I didn't just scribble down things. I actually tried to make it a little bit literary when I did it. And that helped a lot 25 years later. I also realized that I'd forgotten a lot. I'm so glad that I kept the journal, because I talked to all my friends, all my buddies that were there. They hardly remember anything about the details. They remember the big things, but when you get down to the nitty gritty about things, I have them all tell me nowadays when they read the book, they go, man, I totally forgot about that one thing or that one aspect of it. So I'm glad I wrote it all down.
Yeah, no, it was kind of fun, because in the beginning of the book, you talk about the preparation for the deployment process and, the kind of the spin up. And while I'm a tanker pilot by trade, and I've deployed certainly plenty of times. The whole deployment process and arriving is very similar, but obviously in the fighter world, it's a little bit different. Can you talk a little bit about, as you were going through the, writing the book and transcribing some of the thoughts from that journal, some of the process involved with how you guys prepared and got ready to go into this relatively new environment, because this was not originally the kind of combat environment that you were specifically trained for, being based out of the UK, correct?
Yeah, this was totally new to us. We had been training for World War III, which was ostensibly going to take place on the northern plains of Germany near the Fulda Gap. And we envisioned that hordes of Russian tanks were going to roll across the border and invade the West, West Germany, and that at that time, and then over into England. And so that's what we prepared for. We were low altitude, hide behind the trees, hide behind the hills kind of guys, and pop up at the last second, deliver the bomb, and then get back down in low altitude. And as soon as the Gulf War started to look like it was going to happen, we realized, there's nothing to hide behind. There's no hills, first of all. So we started to practice for a more medium altitude or higher altitude, in our case, environment, where we became Stuka dive bombers, where we were going to have to drop our bombs from a 30 or 45 degree dive bomb from 10,000 feet, and then drop the bomb and then get back upstairs as quickly as you could to get out of the threat. So that was all new. We had to start practicing that in England before we went. And then just the desert itself is just vast, and it all looks the same. There's no way to navigate without an INS or GPS. We didn't have GPS actually at the time. So it was very, very unusual for us to fly there. And I think I got about four flights before the war started in theater, south of the border, obviously. But the first couple of weeks were a big learning experience, and we studied a lot. We looked at a lot of maps. We flew and looked across the border, got our binoculars out and looked over there to see what we could see. But other than that, we kind of got thrown into it off the deep end and just started adapting on the fly. So we were really successful and also really lucky. We were lucky that we had air support. We were lucky that we had guys flying CAP that took care of all the air-to-air threats. We didn't have to worry about getting shot down by MiGs. You know, the F-15s were up there capping for us. And without that, we would have probably had much more of a slaughter than than we wanted, than we were anticipating. It just all came together, and our ROE that was given to us was also really good for us, because we could pretty much work the way we wanted to work and use the tactics that we knew were going to work.
That's great. Yeah. So in your book, Hogs in the Sand, you kind of highlighted that vignette of trying to learn that new way of high altitude attack, where you take a relatively large dive angle somewhat. And can you tell us a little bit about that vignette without giving anything away from the book? But can you kind of describe a little bit of why that was unusual? I seem to remember an anecdote where you scared yourself a little bit, which is, you know, kind of a rite of passage of all pilots, right? You push the limits really, and then until you kind of find them.
Yep. I talk about the new lieutenants having a bag of luck and a bag of experience, and you try not to drain the luck before you get all the experience. You know, you transfer from one bag to the other. We had that happen quite a few times in England. Several months before we deployed, we were starting to do high altitude dive bombing. And I had an incident, and several people did, where we're doing these 45 degree dive bombs. And at first you try to make the dive angle look steep, because you're used to 30 degree ones. So you just go, well, let's make it look steep and that'll be 45. And then after a while you start to get comfortable at 45. And what happens is you're still trying to make it look steep and you end up at 60 or 70 degrees of dive angle. And at that dive angle, you can get over your red line really quick and really, really scare yourself. And I'll just say that I've been there and done that. And so that applies to all of aviation. As you suggested, there's always something that you push the limits a little bit and you end up going, oh, okay, that limit is there for a reason, or, oh, I'm not going to go across that line anymore.
Yep. No, I remember early on in pilot training when I was flying tweets, probably second or third solo, you're just starting to get comfortable and you're out in the area doing your loops and your Cuban eights and whatnot. And I think I was doing maybe a split S or an Emelman or something like that. And just got the rudders mixed up and went the wrong way and ended up doing about 10 minutes of aerobatics and about 30 minutes of border patrol after that. So yeah, it's one of those things that kind of, it sneaks up on you quick and sobers you really fast. So
amazing that they give second lieutenants jets, isn't it?
I know. Yeah, I always tell people this is the only career field where you can end up taking a jet out by yourself as a 20-something-year-old flying around the world. I mean, there's a lot of really cool stuff that we get the opportunity to do. So, you know, obviously the combat environment is different. This was your first deployment, I'm assuming, correct?
First combat deployment, yeah. And that was, like, at the time, again, we had, the U.S. had not been in a war of any kind, a real war, since Vietnam. You know, we'd had the raids on Gaddafi in Libya, and we had the Panama attacks. But other than that, the U.S. had not been at war. I think one person in my squadron, no, it wasn't even in my squadron, it was another squadron that we shared a building with. A couple of those guys had been in war in Vietnam, but nobody else had combat time at all. Not the most senior lieutenant colonel even had any combat time. So this was all totally new to us. And I know nowadays, oh my gosh, everybody has combat time. But at the time, you know, it was an unknown.
And it's kind of fun, yeah. Growing up in the Air Force, you read a lot of books and historical accounts of, you know, the Korean War, Vietnam, even as far back, you know, the World War I, World War II. And now we're starting to live in that era where a book like yours is going to become a historical account of something that many of us have actually lived through. And, you know, it's one of those things that's really important to preserve for posterity so we can look back and think about, you know, what night one felt like. So obviously that was a little bit before my time. I didn't get to spend thousands of hours in the skies of Iraq until, you know, well into Operation Enduring Freedom. But can you tell us a little bit about what the morale, the ethos, and the camaraderie was like, and leading up until, you know, night one of Desert Storm and actually crossing the border for the first time. And what stood out to you in terms of, you know, what that first sortie felt like?
The squadron, my squadron was really pumped up, as we all were, you know, just totally motivated and ready to go, but also a little scared. I mean, there was a lot of sleeplessness and, you know, indigestion going into this. We had been told by senior leadership that possibly 30% of us weren't going to get through the war. That was a popular story that went through the squadrons. So we kind of looked around at each other and went, geez, you know, there's all my buds, you know, one of us may not get home. So that was a little bit spooky. Day one of the war, you know, we got our tasking early in the morning. Most of us took off at 5:30 to 6. I got delayed by maintenance and didn't take off till 10 or so, but went to a target in Kuwait, went across the border, and immediately we hooked up with a forward air controller flying an OV-10, believe it or not, Marine. And he had already been there for a couple hours scouting around down at 6,000 feet and had identified a bunch of targets for us. And so we went in on a radar artillery site and pickled our Mark 82 bombs on this site, and then started heading for the coastline, where there was another guy to work us, another forward air controller who was a Navy SEAL, who was sitting in concealment someplace and wanted us to shoot at an observation post. Got some Mavericks there. And then the AAA started. We started dodging that. And about that time, we hit bingo, and we had to come home. So we did. The whole time, not really thinking about the altitude that we had been at. We got back and kissed the ground a little bit and then went in and debriefed. And then we started hearing stories from other guys about how they've been going down in at 5,000 or 6,000 feet and dropping bombs at 3,000. And we all looked at each other and went, you know, we're right in the threat envelope. We have got to rethink this. And so we did. And the next day we started moving it up a little bit, and we started dropping bombs at 9,000 or 10,000 feet, the Maverick up at 7,000 to 10,000 feet. So that first day was a little bit of an anomaly. We kind of pushed it a little bit. We were fairly lucky. We got one bullet hole in one of our airplanes, not mine. It was a guy in my squadron. Overall, I think there were a couple planes lost that first day, but overall we learned a lot on the first day. And after that, we got a lot smarter. So it wasn't until, I think the first 2 weeks was really kind of bad weather. When the weather got better, then the war really kicked into gear. And I have a chapter in my book called February Fear. That was the second month of the war, and it was February, and it was a whole different war, because now the Iraqis started figuring out how we were operating. They started shooting a lot at us. We started losing guys and losing airplanes. And so that was like a whole other war, really. So it was... It was interesting. The first couple days, we all just kind of in a daze, kind of figure out whether we were just lucky or whether we were good. We figured out in the end that it was a combination of both.
Prior preparation and training, it really all comes together. And then, like you said, you got to take some of that that luck out of your bag and move it over in the experience column when you have that opportunity. And hopefully you don't run out of that luck before you get through gaining the experience, right?
Really. And nowadays, I think that the training that we have in the military is really, really good. It was then too, but it's now, it's kept up with the times a lot. And I think I really envy you guys that are flying now in a lot of the new weapon systems. You have tools available that we just never even dreamed of. We didn't even have GPS. You know, our bombs were totally unguided. Our bombs, a lot of them, were just free fall bombs. And so you had to have bombing skills. You had to be able to, you know, this day and age, you can designate a target and be sure that your probability of killing it is up around 100%. That's awesome. That takes a lot of the fear factor of, well, A, not only delivering the weapon, but also, geez, did I drop it on the right target? That's nice to have. So I'm envious. Mm-hmm.
Sure. And it brings up the question of automation management and, you know, how many screens is too many screens. And, you know, you put the EFB in the cockpit and everything, you know, there just gets to be a information overload. But it's nice that I'm sure to a certain extent, the A-10 is still the same jet that it was for the most part when you were flying it. And it's nice to see it still around. I know that there's been talk of trying to retire the airframe, and my personal opinion is there's just nothing that can do the job the same way, automation aside and technological improvements, that there's just nothing that can take the battle damage like the A-10 can. I think that's it's one of the coolest looking airplanes out there, really, isn't it?
It is. It just looks like something out of Star Wars.
Yeah.
So that was what first attracted me before I even knew what it did. I just said, wow, that is cool. So, and yeah, the A-10 now is the same A-10 it was. It's just better. When I crawl into a C model and look at it, it's just amazing what tools are there, data links and, precision delivery that we didn't have. So it's hopefully it'll soldier on. We had those discussions back in my day too, about whether it was going to be retired or not. And, right after Desert Storm, there was a lot of discussion about, hey, it did its job. Now we're going to retire it and move on. But it's still here. So,
well, another anecdote from the book that I thought was fascinating that I hadn't really thought about is the A-10 used to be green, kind of a camo paint scheme, and has since transitioned to an Air Force gray, paint scheme sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about some of the testing that you guys did to explore the color of the airplane before you deployed and things like that? Because I thought that was a really fun part of the book there.
Yeah, the green that we had was directly derivative of where we were operating, which was Europe. And so it was literally called the European One camouflage scheme. And when we realized that not all of our wars were going to be fought in Europe, we started exploring other options, and one of them that came out was this gray paint scheme. We and some other squadrons tested the gray paint scheme. We actually had one painted over a weekend, and this was in the fall before we deployed. We knew we were going to the desert. We said, well, hey, let's try a gray paint scheme. So we took this one jet, and over the weekend it became our ghost airplane, came this light gray, and we went out and flew against it, and oh my god, it was super effective. The plane just became a ghost. It just appeared at slant ranges of more than about 6,000 or 8,000 feet. It was just not there. And we had a false canopy painted on the bottom of it, so you couldn't tell, which way the plane had rolled, which was awesome. And we all thought, this is great. We're going to go down to the desert with gray jets. Somebody at headquarters said, no, paint it back green. And the reason we think they did it is because we didn't really have the time to paint all 18 jets light gray. And also, if we did have them gray, we went down there, we'd have an unfair advantage against the other six squadrons that were down there. So I don't know. We had our green flight suits, our black boots, our green airplanes. We stood out like a sore thumb in the desert. And, we cursed it every chance we got, and we grumbled and moaned. We even had there was a reserve squadron down there, the Cajuns, who actually took delivery of tan flight suits late in the war. And I guess a couple of guys showed up one morning to brief with these things, and the wing commander said, take those off. So we were just not camouflaged at all. Right after Desert Storm is when the fleet started getting painted gray. I mean, it was in the States, I think that summer after the war, they started painting jets gray. So, and it's a great color for it. But, yeah, there's something classic about the old green camo, though. Kind of looks cool.
Yeah, no, I've had the opportunity to refuel. It was at least one green one. I'm not sure. Maybe it was a throwback or something, temporary. But I thought that was kind of fun. And then I just a quick war story of mine is I was over Afghanistan on a terrible weather night. And we were fragged to refuel a couple of A-10s, and we could not find clear air anywhere. And of course, you're down lower than the tanker normally it prefers to be, and in the mountains and fighting clouds. And of course, it's in the middle of the night, so you can't hardly tell what are clouds and what's just dark. And there was icing. I mean, it was of course the middle of summer, but in the clouds there's icing. We had the hardest time finding clear air, but these guys needed their gas and they needed to get down to support a tick. And, You know, it was just one of those times where it was just us and them working to get the mission done, and we knew there was something more important. Unfortunately, we picked up a lot of ice on our engines and had a little bit of damage to what we call the acoustic panels. But you know, it was one of those things where there just wasn't anything you could do. There was no clear air to be found. But
Well, God bless the tankers. They they saved our butts more than once. I mean, there really were some hairy stories that came out of Desert Storm and every war, really, that have been averted by tankers pushing onwards and flying low in the mountains, flying across the border. We had that happen quite a few times. In fact, some tanker guys came and picked us up. I think it was around 30 miles north of the border. It was in western Iraq. Thank God they were there.
Looking at the arc of your career, and obviously, you know, that was a pivotal, a very foundational moment in your aviation journey. So what has that taught you that you employ now? Right now you're an airline pilot, you fly a lot of warbirds and also general aviation, like you were saying. So what kind of lessons have you brought forward from that time flying the hog and, you know, in a combat environment or just in general that have really stood the test of time in your mind?
The big one is things are not always, not ever as bad as your mind can imagine. There's a lot of challenges in aviation, and some of them are life-threatening, some are just career-threatening. So when I first started flying the A-10, you know, I was a typical 25-year-old lieutenant, bulletproof, and thought he was going to live forever. I guess the wartime experience taught me that's not true. That's what really got me out of my bulletproof phase and into the phase of I need to do things smart. That was really what turned the corner for me. I realized that the only person who was interested in my self-preservation was, of course, me. And so I needed to approach everything with a healthy dose of caution along with the optimism. And so that has served me really well along the way. I never assume that I know everything. I never assume that I'm the luckiest guy in the squadron or in the air or in the formation or whatever. And I've seen really a lot of good guys who get caught up in this feeling that, you know, I've been through everything. What could possibly happen? I still am kind of a wimp when it comes to stuff. And that has worked really well for me. I've had some extraordinary circumstances that have challenged that and have maybe really worked for a successful outcome. But I don't just jump into stuff willy-nilly. And so if you keep a healthy skepticism and a healthy attitude or a healthy feeling of dread in the back of your mind, I think you can still have a lot of fun and you can still get a lot done in your career. But anyway, that's kind of how I would put it.
Just a good, healthy respect for the machine and weather and the things you can't control. You know, you can study all you want and you can chair fly and do whatever you got to do, but you can't control that thunderstorm and you can't control what's going to happen on the airplane to a certain extent at any given time. So you have to be prepared for that.
Be the guy who does a thorough walk around, even though you've done 1,000 of them before.
You never know when you're going to find that fuel drip that is just slightly more than it should be or something like that, right?
Safety we're missing or whatever.
No, that's awesome. So I see that you've hit Amazon bestseller, number one bestseller. So that congratulations on that. That's a huge milestone, I'm sure. If people want to find the book, obviously Amazon's a good place for that. Where else, if they want to reach out and ask some questions or talk about the book or just get their hands on it, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, Amazon's still, you know, the 800-pound gorilla, but it's available at Barnes & Noble. If you don't have it in your stores, they can order it for you, but they have it online. Pretty much every other place you buy books, you know, Kindle, Nook. If you're overseas, you know, there's the foreign sellers, Waterstones, and I forget the name of the dealer in Australia, but everybody's got it or can get it really quickly. The website for the book is hogsinthesand.com, and on there you can buy the book there also, You can also look at some cool videos that I put together, just some YouTube videos. I'm eventually going to get some of the videos that I have from Desert Storm stuck on YouTube and embedded there. Right now with COVID going on, it's really tough for me to get out and sign books. So what we're doing is I've got some book plates, which are essentially really fancy stickers that have an A10 on them, and I'll sign them, personalize them, send them out. Those are available on the website. And then there's also a contact page there, and you can go on and send me a note, and it goes right to my email, and I answer every single one. Sometimes it takes me a couple of days, but I relish hearing from people and talking to people about, you know, what they're doing, what, you know, talking about the book, anything they want to ask, really. So that's a good way to do it. If you buy the book, my email address is actually in the front part of the book there, so you can get hold of me there too.
Okay. Well, great. Well, Buck, we really appreciate you being on the show and talking to us a little bit about Hogs in the Sand and your experiences there. I know we're living through commemoration of that particular event, and you're a big part of that history moving forward. And we really appreciate you putting it down into pen and paper, so it's there and preserved for the rest of us. So thank you for that. And hopefully once we get a little farther down, past COVID, we can have you back on the show and come meet with us in person and have an adult beverage or two.
I'd love to do it. Thank you very much, Matt. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And TPN, as always, if you want to get a hold of Adam or myself, you can email us at heyguys@thepilotnetwork.org, or you can find us on Facebook or on the TPN private community, and anywhere that in the TPN ecosystem we're there and willing to help out and connect you with anyone. And as always, so usually we sign off with keep the shiny side up and the dirty side down, but in this case, that doesn't really apply. So we'll invert that. We'll do a split S and do a steep dive. So take care, everybody, and fly safe.